Here we are, bodhisattvas, honoring the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the spiritual leader of the civil rights movement and the leader today of his dream to realize the truth of the freedom and justice for everybody. So Martin Luther King was driven by the belief in the equality and dignity of all people. This was written into the Constitution. And Dr. King speaks the words of the Dharma when he says, "We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects us directly affects all indirectly." I didn't know till today that the last book that Dr. King wrote was titled, "Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community?" I mean, today, as we all know, we're surrounded by crises of violent violations of human dignity. So we have to ask the same question. Where do we go from here? Chaos or community? And I feel that we're on the cusp of the possibility of transformation, but this possibility is real only if we don't turn away. And as white people, most of us live in this unconscious bubble of white privilege. The comfortability of our lives is now being called into question. Our invisible white privilege sustains a kind of suffering, of isolation, a false sense of knowledge, delusions of the separate individual, and unearned advantages. Our social conditioning keeps us blind and illiterate. Like, I grew up in a small suburb city in St. Louis, and, you know, I didn't even know until I was 13 that several blocks down from my church was where all the Black people lived. So even to learn that I grew up in a segregated community, I didn't know. I was just in that bubble, you know, my family pushing towards whatever options were open to me because I was white. So all my liberal idealism really missed this major point. And my comfortability of life made it easy to not see. So I've learned that for us as white people, we have to be intentional in our self-reflection and our study to begin to see systemic racism as it is expressed through our laws, institutions, educational and medical systems, and systems of law and order. As white people, we need to turn towards what's uncomfortable and to inquire about what we don't yet know about ourselves. We need to do this in community. It just is too hard, and we're easily led astray if we try to do this alone, because we need to become resilient so that we can wholeheartedly engage in addressing one of the deepest sources of suffering in our society. So with this awareness, Linda Decker and I got together last summer and we developed this study group, which we called White Supremacy, White Privilege, and the Dharma. And it was our hope that we could come together and study to become what some people call racially literate, and also to create an environment where we feel safe, where we can go and introspect to reflect on ourselves and our own white privilege. We also wanted to learn more about what the Dharma is saying to us as bodhisattvas to act in such a way that we are anti-racist. So we developed this course and 15 people in our Sangha participated. We met every other week for 12 weeks and we had 6 sessions, and most everybody is here tonight. So we began by reading the book White Rage by Carol Anderson. And this is basically an incredibly detailed, researched history of the development of slavery and what happened after the emancipation, after the official end of slavery, and how everything was constituted in such a way that the laws were changed, institutions were developed, regulations were set in, many violent actions were overlooked, just to make sure that even after emancipation, Black people were basically left out, exiled from our society, exiled as full human beings. So she began to see that there was a pattern of the, what she calls white backlash, that whenever the African-American, the Black people began to be successful, began to actually accomplish and begin to do well, the white privilege, the white supremacy leadership would pull back and create barriers and blockades and more violence to keep the Black people subjugated. This book was difficult for us to read. As a group, we were horrified by what we read. And almost everyone in this group said, "I had no idea. I never learned this in school. Why didn't I know all of this?" And at first we sort of blamed ourselves, you know, like, what were we out to lunch, or, you know, where were we? But then we began to realize, no, this is the way our system was set up. Our educational system, our economic system, just so that we wouldn't know, that this would keep us as white people passive and in our bubble of illiteracy without the truth. In this way, we wouldn't be empowered to speak out and to try to change the system that perpetuates racism. So this was just the beginning. We studied trauma. We studied resources to awaken the Dharma through the lens of race. We explored how we might engage in difficult conversations where racism is functioning. We looked at how we might learn to discern actions in our everyday lives to speak out against racism. So tonight our panel is going to be here to share their learnings and their experience. That most of the themes of our study group will be addressed through our panel. And I'm very honored that our panel will be speaking tonight. And after I'm in a few moments, Linda will add her sort of reflections on our context. And then our panel consists of Sarah O'Gara, and Jim Hare, and Dusk Angel, and Karen Hamilton. And that's the order of their presentations. And then after each person has shared, then we will have some time for questions and further discussion. That will be our evening program. So, Linda.
We probably should have shared notes, Dorley, so forgive me for any repetition, but my comments are really brief. We started out actually with also with D'Angelo's book, White Privilege, and examining our white privilege. And in doing that, it opened us to the realization that we are white with capital W. It's a social construct, but we are a white race in the same sense that other, you know, there's a Black race. All of them socially constructed, but in our country, our, quote, white culture is has a deep and historical thread of white supremacy. And it has become the default norm of our culture. We don't eat, white people don't even notice it because we don't have to. we're not oppressed by it. And this began to open us up. And when we face these things and we look at our privilege, and we realize that you don't have to be an ugly, overt racist to support systemic racism. And it's a painful thing to realize. And it requires us to set aside our defensiveness, our denial, and our own woundedness. And the oppressor is wounded as well as the oppressed. It's a fact. And I was so inspired by the words of Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams regarding this. And I'm going to finish my remarks by just reading a paragraph from her. It's an invitation to us as Buddhists, I think. I think we are finally at a place where we can accept the truth that no one escapes from oppression, not one of us. Everyone is deeply wounded. It's true, some people seem to be in a position of what we call privilege, but we have to rethink that word. We get stuck on this notion of white privilege or dominant privilege as if the marginalized people want what the people with privilege have. But I want no part of it. I want no part of any illness that renders people unable to see the beauty of all of our differences, the beauty of my own mixed raceness, blackness, queerness, all of the things I am. I want no part of an illness that renders me unable to connect to love. That is not a privilege. So we have to begin by recognizing that the construct of white supremacy is an illness. I don't want to wish it on anyone, not on myself and not on you. We have all been told a lie, and our work, particularly for those of us who say we identify with this path of liberation, is to free ourselves of that lie, to get in there and observe that construct and the ways in which it limits us from our full potential. I think Sarah's the next person up.
You're muted.
I'm going to tell you about my experience reading My Grandmother's Hands by Ramesa Menakem. He has his master's in social work and is currently the director of behavioral health for African American Family Services in Minneapolis. He's also a trauma consultant for the public schools and a cultural somatic consultant for the Minneapolis Police Department. His book lays out a different approach to countering racism in American society compared with some other diversity and tolerance training curricula that appeal to our intellect. His training and work as a trauma therapist points to our deep intergenerational racial trauma as the root cause of white privilege. He offers in his book practices and exercises, both individual and communal, to heal the internalized trauma white people hold in their bodies that triggers the micro and overt aggressions towards Black people that arise from our autonomic nervous system, not our higher brain. The stereotypes of Black people as dangerous or hypersexual, insensitive to pain, are linked with white people feeling themselves as fragile and vulnerable. These internalized physical responses arise from our intergenerational racial trauma. Outnumbered plantation owners lived in fear of an insurrection. To justify holding another human being in bondage, white people had to internalize a depersonalization of the Black person. The murder of Tamir Rice, a boy on a playground with a toy gun, illustrates how this internalized racial trauma works in us. The police officer who murdered Tamir shot before he got out of his vehicle. And at the trial, he said he saw a threatening man drawing a gun. He said he feared for his life at the trial. Menakem argues that indeed the officer did fear for his life, coming from the deep internalized racialized trauma that he held in his body for Black people. He couldn't even see a 12-year-old boy on the playground. He saw a dangerous Black body with a gun. Because it is our lizard brain, our autonomic nervous system, and not our higher intellect that holds on to white privilege, Menenkem suggested that we cannot heal internalized racial trauma with study groups alone. He points to the false fragility of white bodies who may say, I'm Jewish, I'm Muslim, I'm lesbian, I grew up poor, so I face the same oppression as African Americans. Others point to statistics. Black people commit more crimes than white people, so racial profiling is okay. Or often blaming the victim instead of the racial bias that was the underlying cause for the inequity. White people who see themselves as good and not racist, but when their deep biases are pointed out, become defensive. I have a Black friend, they say, or even. Menenkem's premise is racism does not happen in our heads. It happens in our body. And that to dismantle our white privilege, we need to embrace the embodied trauma by moving through clean pain to discharge and free ourselves. What he means by this is to notice emotions in the body instead of reacting to them, to accept the discomfort of our racialized response instead of trying to flee from it, staying present in the body with the ambiguity and the uncertainty of the experience of racial discomfort. And as I look here at all the faces in this practice circle, I'm looking at a sea of white. Dismantling our white privilege is not an intellectual process from a study group or from this discussion. It can start here, but it can't end there. The practices and exercise in Menenkem's book offer techniques to dismantle this. Since reading this volume, I have started to explore the sources of my own racism. It was not hard to pinpoint, but it has been exceedingly difficult to accept that the people that I love and respect, my parents and grandparents, passed on to me not only their DNA, but their deeply hateful racial attitudes. When I first started to date, my mother gave me a talk. It wasn't about sex. It was that Black people's families are not like white people's, so I should never date a Black boy. We moved 3 times when we lived in Los Angeles. In retrospect, it was because the Black community was moving too close. I remember my aunt saying, when my cousin Terry married Denise, thank God she's not that Black. And Zora May, a Black woman who worked for my grandparents for many years, cooking and cleaning for them. In his later years, my grandfather fell when he had a small stroke, and Zora May went to help him get up. He stared into her face and said, "What's this Black woman doing in my house?" So these are my intergenerational racial traumas that I'm working with, trying to help dismantle my white privilege. And one of Menenkem's techniques that I found most useful as I did these explorations of my personal history was to hum or to chant the mantra, Om. Menenkem says vocalizations like these vibrate in the chest near the vagus nerve. And I found that these techniques would soothe my discomfort and allow me to look in the face my personal racial trauma and begin to put a chink in my white privilege.
Thank you so much, Sarah. I think, Jim, are you next?
Yes, well, thank you. Well, it's been a long time since we've been able to be together, but when we and we haven't done many ceremonies as we used to do when we were able to be at the Dharma Center. But when we were at the Dharma Center, about every quarter we would do the full moon ceremony. And for those of you that have done it, or those of you who haven't, the full moon ceremony begins with a verse that's known as the confession and repentance verse. And it goes, all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And that's repeated three times, as many of the verses are in the full moon ceremony. So this is also called the Bodhisattva ceremony. Confession and repentance and that verse that I just recited is the beginning and where we start in that ceremony. And I want to say that when I started this class, that we're speaking about, I wouldn't say that I considered my status as a white person to be, you know, part of my ancient twisted karma. My status as a white person was, as far as I could see, just a given. It was just how I was born. But I think one of the results of this class is that I now actually see my status as a white person as part of my ancient twisted karma. I see that status, which I used to, you know, view just as a fact, as something that I need to consider more deeply in relationship to the fact that not every person is white. And there is a society that has been created, and part, not all, but part of the fabric of that society is an inequality that's been created between people based on race and economic factors and other you know, markers, but there's a certain privilege that's certainly because you know, white people had the power when they came to this continent, and they had, you know, whatever superior technology that allowed them to dominate and exploit. And whereas, you know, I didn't participate in any of that original, you know, exploitation and domination, I'm an heir to that. And people who look like me continue to be the dominant people in our politics, in our economics, and culture. So I now do understand that my status and the privileges, which I could name many privileges that I've had, I certainly acknowledge having received many privileges that, you know, I took to be, as I think Glenda was saying. I mean, this is part of the you could say delusion of white people is that, you know, our, you know, white people's dominance or privilege it's sort of like the natural order of things. It's just the norm. It's just the average. And then the ideal is just to raise everybody up to, if you have an ideal, it's just to raise everybody up to what white people have. But white people already have it, and they assume they have it, and they take it for granted. And so that's part of this analysis that's being done is, it's like our practice of turning the light back. turn the light back and look at this, this thing that you take for granted and question it. Question this, you know, the status, you know, that you have and the privileges that you've received. And I think for me at the beginning, I had some resistance to this. Because of this idea that this is the norm, you know, I'm just a normal person, right? I'm just happened to be white. But if we really, if we see, which is so pretty easy to see, if you, you know anything, you don't have to even go into these studies very deeply to know that what has been developed in this society is an unequal in aspects, not in every aspect, but there's an underlying inequality, there's underlying injustice, and that has been, that is sort of, it's embedded in race and whiteness and white dominance of the culture. And so we really, I think this whole idea is just like looking back at that, and whether it's almost immaterial whether we think we're contributing to that right now or our parents did or anything like that. It's like, no, we're just the heirs to that. We've inherited that. That's our inheritance. And that's what we need to acknowledge that and understand that, you know, we don't always, you know, we only have these eyes that look out, and we need to remember that other people have eyes and they look at us. And we have to understand that what other people see in us and make that part of our reality. So if we're white and privileged, we can't, you know, or I recommend based on this study, not taking that as the norm and really, you know, the basis of empathy is really an imaginative process. How do other people see me, and how do other people relate to me and the status that I have and so forth? And then, and by that kind of empathetic understanding, we have the chance to become humble and more understanding and do more listening and not assume our status is a given. And I guess the last thing I want to say is, because I don't want to take too much time, but the one thing about this, doing this work, is that understanding yourself as if you're white as having privilege, it doesn't mean that like you somehow turn against yourself and you think, well, you know, I'm part of this oppressor class. So it's not really a process of turning against yourself or turnaround, but it's just a process of understanding that there are a multiplicity of viewpoints, and that your viewpoint is only one, but you've inherited this kind of powerful viewpoint, and that's what we need to really question, the power of our viewpoint and the dominance of our viewpoint, and be in a kind of posture of, you know, fostering and allowing and promoting other viewpoints, letting the multiplicity of viewpoints come forward. And And, you know, maybe some of that is taking a step back sometimes. So the one article I would really recommend, if you want like a 3-page primer on white privilege, this wonderful article written in 1988, by the way, by Peggy McIntosh, White Privilege Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. 3 pages, and you will really, I think you could read those and you would really get it. So I recommend that article. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. Now we're going to hear from Dusk.
Thank you. I entered the study group as someone who was a leftist and an activist, already well-versed in many societal issues. I have spent most of my life fighting for what's right, protesting, organizing, and radicalizing individuals with the open minds to listen. But the number one thing I've learned as an activist is that I can and should always learn more. I can always keep my mind porous, willing to absorb any new information and change my old ideas about the world. All things are impermanent after all, and that includes worldviews. That was my main motivation for joining this group, and I am pleased to say I learned so much from it and was forced to confront things about myself that I was perfectly content ignoring. In our very first reading assignment, I learned horrible things about Abraham Lincoln that I never knew. I did know he was a lot worse than the history books say he was, but I didn't realize the full extent. History is written by the victors, after all, and this book club made that more apparent than ever. But learning is only a single step. Again, as a leftist, I read theory about communism, gender, colonization, etc. all the time. However, that knowledge is fairly useless without implementation. That is why our fifth session, titled Skillful Means, was such an important and impactful one for me. I am an incredibly outspoken person most of the time, but even I find myself shrinking up in certain situations, such as when a family member of mine said a racial slur casually in front of me, and I reacted by shriveling up, staying silent, and trying to just ignore it and change the subject. In Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine, I was forced to confront this. In one excerpt, the neighbor of the author calls the cops on the Black man babysitting for her. In our discussion, we were asked if we would confront the neighbor who called the cops. I was immediately brought back to that moment with my family member where I'd been silent and had to come to terms with the fact that no, I probably wouldn't have. But I should. I should always use my white body and the privilege it holds to protect others. I share leftist ideas all day long and ask people to protect my trans body. The least I could do is speak up and protect someone else facing an oppressive situation, even if they're not in the room, such as when my family member said the racial slur. After all, oppression still exists even when someone is not there. We can talk about these issues all day long, but until we commit to change our behaviors, it really doesn't mean that much. I have made that commitment now. There is no situation where I will be silent like that again. Silence is violence, after all, something I've always known and something I've always said, but something which I haven't stood by 100% of the time when the situations actually present themselves. It's sad that it took a group like this for me to confront these issues within myself. I've gone to so many Black Lives Matter protests and stood up for my Black friends and colleagues in the past, convincing myself over and over that I do what's right when I need to do so always. But when confronting the subject truthfully, I found that that isn't actually the case. I do have blind spots, we all do. That is the important part of continuing to learn and engage. No one can ever see perfectly clearly, but they can commit themselves to finding as many of these blind spots as possible, shining a light upon them and retraining their minds. These dark places in the mind are not moral failures unless we shine the light upon them and then choose to turn it back off, unwilling to engage in deciding instead to ignore them. I will not allow myself to remain in the darkness if I can help it. I am committed to shining a light upon all those spots and retraining my behaviors accordingly. I hope you will all join me in that commitment. I have begun to remind myself of it every time I make my bodhisattva vow. I can actively spread compassion to beings who need my voice, and I should. Not hypothetically, but literally in my actions. I should alleviate their suffering whenever possible. That is my vow, and that is the lesson I took away from this group. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dusk. Thank you. Now we'll hear from Karen Hamilton.
Thank you, Dorley and Linda and everyone else who was participating in this group. I will say that I also was very moved and well troubled much of the time during the group, but I think we all, you know, have to face. We had a lot to face, and so that is difficult work. And it's really great to have Sangha friends to help us do that. I think well, we did a lot of reading, and what it led to for me is actually to do more reading and take up just some slightly different looks at some of the topics we discussed. And the first one I that was very powerful for me is called Just Mercy by a man named Brian Stevenson, who is, you know, as far as I can tell, a bodhisattva and has been doing bodhisattva work for quite some time through his organization. He is a Black lawyer who started an organization called Equal Justice Initiative. Anyway, in this book, which has also been made into a film, he relays what happened and how he got into the work of helping people who were in prison, who had been either wrongly convicted and or too severely punished, or they were treated as an adult, even though they were children. So that is his work and his organization's work. I think what was, it was shocking to me really to realize that I've had probably way too much faith in our criminal justice system, really, that I came away thinking, well, who are the real criminals here? When you have this reveal about many cases all over the country, this man's work, Brian Stevenson's work, is primarily in Alabama and Georgia, but I think it goes on throughout the country. So I just wanted to tell you about that. There's also online, I haven't watched this video either, about him and his work called True Justice, Brian Stevenson's Fight for Equality. And it's, I think it's a shorter video, and it's online for free. And also on his website, he has a section called How You Can Help. And so the reading kind of led me to thinking about, well, yes, we're reading, we're educating ourselves. But it seems like the problem is so vast. What else? You know, what else? What? So I did find a list. It's actually on KQED's website that was recommended from another website. So there are five ways to show up for racial justice today. Donate to on the ground activists. I mean, I have to admit that I do go out and march sometimes, but at least during the pandemic, I haven't. And So what I can still donate to those organizations that do. I can help to support them. Number two, help when it's not an emergency, meaning help organizations that provide food or housing or health services. In our local community. And number three is educate yourself. So I guess I have a lot of educating to do. So I thought I knew something because I actually had, when I was in graduate school, I took a lot of Black studies and Black literature. And so I've read some of the classics, but the books that we were reading in this group are more contemporary and a lot more up to date. So you can contact your lawmakers and you can vote. And number five, you can talk to your community. One thing I forgot to say that I learned through reading the Just Mercy book is that I hadn't really quite comprehended how putting so many people in prison damages it causes so much suffering beyond even the person who has been incarcerated. The families and the communities. And then when this person does get out of jail or prison, they can't vote. And so that also is a great hindrance. Or they can't get a job. So it's difficult. So back to talk to your community. I mean, I guess like Dusk, I did grow up in a family that was pretty, some of my family was pretty openly racist. And I was not able to stand up to that when I was younger. And I have since, I've done some study of nonviolent communication method by Marshall Rosenberg. And so I was glad to see that on their website, there are some articles specifically about how to confront racism when you meet it. And I actually had some thoughts that maybe as a group, maybe after the pandemic, I don't know, but we could have someone who's been trained in nonviolent communication to help us with that would be a good project. And just to kind of wind up here, I also there's a therapist on the NVC, the Nonviolent Communication website, named Roxy Manning, who has done some writing about this issue. More recently, I have gone on to another book called How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. And we read one article by him that was published in the Atlantic Monthly, but for the end of our class. So I was inspired by that article to go on to, I mean, just the title, How to Be an Anti-Racist, is so compelling. And I haven't gotten real far in it, but I'm very impressed so far. But just to his definitions, he actually doesn't seem to think you know, the terms racist or racism are very helpful sometimes. He says that anti-racist is well, let me back up. He says, you know, race discrimination is not very helpful way to look at it. Racism is a powerful collection of racist policies that lead to racial inequity and are substantiated by racist ideas. But anti-racism is a powerful collection of anti-racist policies that lead to racial equity and are substantiated by anti-racist ideas. He really sees the bigger picture that it isn't, you know, I guess as maybe Jim was saying it, you know, whether I think, oh, I'm too racist or I'm not, or whatever, it isn't so important as the overall picture of how it's the racist policies and our capitalism probably, and our way of capitalism anyway, create laws and structures that allow for such inequality. I watched a talk with Linda Cutts, I guess it was yesterday, on Sunday, and she was talking about the Lotus Sutra, chapter 25, and she stated, you know, the work of the Bodhisattva is to undertake great compassion without delay. So I'm kind of keeping that in my mind.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, and thank you, Linda and Dusk and Sarah and Karen and Jim, for your open and, courageous, self-revealing sharing. And if we bring everybody together now, this can be a time, if you have some questions that you want to ask someone or just want to share, you know, something that's come up for you about this, you know, very challenging and important arena of, you know, white supremacy and white privilege. Please raise your hand. I see Del. Unmute yourself, please.
Yes, thank you, Doralee, and thank you everyone who spoke. I really, really appreciated it. One of the things I did want to say, though, especially in relation to the prison and in relation to the police and even social workers and things like that, we have an incredibly expensive, unworking system. I mean, we spend so much money on control and so little money on education and reform that it makes me crazy. I just think it, you know, we really need to think about the cost that we're all paying through our taxes, whether we want to be paying it or not. And I just think it's a terrible travesty. So anyway, that's what I wanted to add to the discussion.
Yes, thank you for expressing it from your heart. Thank you. Let's see, Peter.
I want to just express my resistance to this whole issue. And one of my favorite expressions about myself that I like to say is that I don't listen, I never have, and I never will. I use that to give myself the best possible listening. So I think it might behoove me and community to say, I'm a racist, I always have been, and I always will. What I'm trying to say as succinctly now as I can is I'm a poor reader. I've been through medical school and residency, and I was not accepted as a practicing doctor for reasons beyond my understanding. And so I am very wary of taking on reading another book. Similar to when I go bicycling or running, one day of activity doesn't make me fit. I need to stay active 5 days a week to stay fit. And I'm saying that I think I would have to read Culture Warlords for a couple of hours every week for the rest of my life to stay in that current learning. And so my request to, and I'm interested in getting involved in this study, is to be treated as somebody who said what I just said. And I really appreciate Karen's 5 steps. You know, I only heard 4 of them actually, but you know, I'm looking for actions of practice. I love it that we can just sit and I don't have to read a lot of instruction about how to sit. Similarly, I'm asking for remembrance that reading doesn't work for some of us. And so we just need to do practice. You know, I'm going to just keep practicing that I am a racist and I am committed to not being such. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Peter. And thank you for expressing the many needs we have to learn about this and to find the actions. Oh, John Katona.
Yes. I was moved by what the panelists shared, especially as each of you talked about how the readings touched you personally and in your practice, your Buddhist practice. My question to each of you is, how was it relating in a group over the 6 weeks or 12 weeks that you met? Because I would imagine you had to do a lot of soul searching and sharing within the context of the group. What was that like for you?
Question to the panel or to anyone who was in the group. I'm thinking, did you raise your hand, Dusk, or no?
I raised mine. Thanks for that question, because there were really some moments of, I remember one of the panel members, or excuse me, not the panel, but the group, the original group, saying, because there were, you know, we were telling stories of our failures to, you know, act well, and in our failures in our past to recognize racism in ourselves and in situations that we were in. And there were just really some moments where I remember somebody saying that they felt just undone by the discussion. And that really hit me. I think that was so right. You know, when you really bring out some of your past and some of the situations you've been in and relationships you've had or failed to have, some of the stories were just quite, devastating for the person telling it and for the people listening to it. And that happened more than once, for sure.
Let's see, Linda.
Jim, do I have your permission to repeat something that you said in a group?
Well, but he won't know what that is, Linda. Let's.
Okay. Well, then, it was very moving. and I find group sharing very difficult. I'm not comfortable in practice circles. I go home and I think of everything dumb I said and wish I hadn't said it. So to go through this experience was just hard in that respect. And then considering the subject matter, it was hard. It was hard, but certainly worth it.
Something that helped me, and I agree, it was very vulnerable to sort of own up to things. And yet I remember that Akendi said, being an anti-racist is primarily confession. Like to become humble in how much we're just learning about ourselves and that we don't know. You know, confession is the process. And so somehow that gave me a little more courage that, you know, not hiding, letting it come out in a safe environment. So I know Richard had his hand up, so I don't want to miss him. But I don't see you on the screen. Where are you? Well, there you are.
I think somebody was before me, Joshua and Laura.
Oh, okay.
I believe they raised their hands before.
Okay, thank you. Joshua?
Hi. Thank you, Richard. I wanted to share, I had a moment in the fall of realizing a moment of white privilege, and I do recognize them quite a lot, but I probably don't recognize them every time, you know, like I ideally would like to. But the DMV did not notify us when it was time for us to renew our vehicle registration like they normally do until it was on like the third late notice. That was like the first notice that we got. And it was due at the end of November, and Christmas was right around the corner, and, you know, we were focused on paying for Christmas. And when we realized we got this notice of now there was, you know, two fines tacked on for it being late, we thought, oh gosh, like if we pay it immediately and postpone Christmas shopping, you know, packages might not get there on time. We might not be able to find things that are hot items. And we thought, let's just finish our Christmas shopping and then we'll pay it, you know, a couple weeks from now. What are the chances that I'll get pulled over, right? What are the chances that a cop's gonna pull me over and even see that the tags are expired because I'm white? And a colleague of mine, a Black colleague, her fiance gets pulled over all the time for no reason is said to him as to why. And they check his license, they check his registration, and they let him go. But I mean, it's frequent. So if I were her or him, I would not have had that train of thought. I would have had to pay it right away. So I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that insight. Wow. Richard.
I would just like to say I enjoyed the panel, and I guess I commend the vulnerability you had or had in your discussion groups. You know, I can visibly see how some things were uncomfortable and unsettling, and, you know, and I think that takes, you know, courage and, you know, to, I would say, view the world through a new lens. It's, you know, privilege is interesting, I think. You're grateful, you're lucky if you have some privilege that you can acknowledge. And I often think about a weird sense of privilege as almost like karma or interdependent, you know, arising, you know, like a lot of it, almost you had no say in, right? Whether you're white, Black, whether your family had more income, or you had an income level before you even gained your own income, whether you're queer or straight, you know, there's all these different layers of America that we all might be blind to, you know, and it takes openness and vulnerability and compassion with yourself to see these things and you know, I would say realize your place in the, I guess, the imaginary but not so imaginary social structure of our world, definitely in these times. And you know, I always think, you know when I hear people being uncomfortable about family members or themselves, you know, I think compassion is the most best thing. I think Jim said it at one point. I don't know exactly what he said, but it's this I don't know if it was like denying yourself, but not taking on too much to a point where you kind of aren't compassionate with yourself. You know, we all make mistakes. And I think, you know, I think even in myself, we all have moments where we're like, oh, we should have said something, but we didn't. And, you know, I often think those things, you got to have compassion with yourself. And just the fact that you're looking at it and seeing it differently is an amazing thing, right? It's almost like getting into Buddhism and the Dharma and like seeing reality, yourself, your connection with things differently, right? And it's sort of like this thing that slowly you have to work at, right? Like it's like all practice, you know. I think Peter said the same thing, right? It's not just like reading. It's almost like explicitly immersing yourself in it and feeling uncomfortable, right? So much good work is feeling uncomfortable. So I like to say, you know, it's a good panel, and you know, thank you for talking and opening yourselves up and being vulnerable.
Wow. Thank you, Richard. I think Rich is next, I think. You have to unmute yourself.
I think Meg had her hand up before I did, but I'll do whatever.
Go ahead.
You're frozen. I'm sorry. I can't hear you.
Oh, please go ahead, Rich.
Okay, sorry, you froze just at the wrong time. Yeah, I really appreciate the open communication and willingness to look within and to communicate. You know, this is a new subject for me, so I'm exploring it. I am curious. I'm an American history buff. I've read lots of American history, and this is a question for Dusk. I'm very curious about, you said something about Abraham Lincoln and all the horrible things that he's done. I'm not aware of that. And so I'd love to know either a reference or some specific things that you could inform me on, please.
Yeah, I just opened up the passage. I actually saved it because I've been showing it to people because it's so harrowing. So I'll just read it to you guys real quick. Lincoln had shown his hand early in the war, heavily influenced by two of his intellectual heroes, Thomas Jefferson, who advocated expulsion of blacks from the United States in order to save the nation, and Kentuckian Henry Clay, who had established the American Colonization Society, which had moved thousands of free blacks into what is now Liberia. Lincoln soon laid out his own resettlement plans. He had selected Chiriqui, a resource poor area in what is now Panama, to be the new home for millions of African Americans. He just had to convince them to leave. He lectured five black leaders, whom he summoned to the White House, that it was their duty, given what his people had done to the United States, to accept the exodus to South America, telling them, "For your race among us, there could not be war." As to just how and why your race came to be among us, Lincoln conveniently ignored. So that was the one thing. And then In the next page, Lincoln's anger in 1862 was directed at Blacks who fully supported the Union and did not want to leave the U.S. Many indeed would exclaim that, despite slavery and enforced poverty, we will work, pray, live, and if need be, die for the Union. Nevertheless, he cast them as the enemy for wickedly dividing the nation. And then one more. I am not, Lincoln had said, nor have I ever been in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the white and Black races. Lincoln had taken early in his political career when he insisted that he was never in favor of Black people voting, or for that matter, serving on juries or holding public offices or intermarrying with whites. So those things like really stood out to me. I had always been taught in school that, you know, Lincoln was against slavery, that he wanted to unify the races, that he wanted Black people to be part of our government and all that stuff. But it turns out, no, he actually wanted them gone, and he blamed them for what was going on in the war, which was very upsetting, of course. And, you know, I had been told that the reason that Lincoln wasn't as great as we thought was because, oh, you know, the war didn't happen because he wanted to end slavery. It happened over other things like taxes or something like that. I don't remember the exact reason I was told. But no, it turns out he actually did blame Black people for all the things going on, and he did not like them very much. And it was very upsetting to learn that stuff. So that's all.
Thank you.
Yes, the book that we read that has some of this in it is White Rage by Carol Anderson. And I would highly recommend that book.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Meg.
Yeah, I first wanted to go back to John's question. I found that being in the group caused me, in fact, to reflect at a deeper level than I might have if I had just read one of these books and then thought about it. Listening to other people's vulnerability and their stories and being able to have that bring up memories and realizing that it was a safe space to talk about these things that are so difficult was really very powerful. I just recently read the quote from Thich Nhat Hanh that talked about Martin Luther King's beloved community that he saw as the Sangha. And I think I've shared in a couple of other venues with this group that partially our week-long sit, the sesshin, partially when I was sick. But profoundly, this study group brought together this sense and understanding better than CPE ever did, John. The sense of being able to share, to know you've been heard, and to hear compassion for each of us and to thus allow ourselves self-compassion really helped to be able to open up my awareness. So I think that doing this in this kind of group setting was invaluable. The second thing that I wanted to do was thank you, Richard. And one of the curiosities that I have had from the beginning of our first study group, and there's one in the Bay Area that I'm not part of, but that I've heard a lot about, is that it's for white people. And, you know, should we be having this conversation without Black people, African Americans present to help us think about what we're doing? And I don't know about that, but I appreciate your input and appreciation of the hard work that I feel like we're doing. I grew up in a white town. The two African Americans in our school happened to be in my class. But I grew up in a home where every single culture of the world and every people's was in and out of it all the time. Intermarriages, different genders. I remember going off to college and coming back and saying, "Dad, are Herb and Roger gay?" And my father said, "Well, I don't know what gay means, but yeah, if you mean asking if they're homosexuals, of course." So you know, I grew up in this very open family and got invited to the prom by one of the few Black people in my high school. And my father said, "You can't go." And I was like, "What? I've seen all this time, and now you're saying no?" I went and was ostracized for the rest of my high school years, my junior and senior year, because of it. But I learned a great deal that day. And I really appreciate your comments, Richard, and your willingness to prod us forward. And I would be interested to hear both you and Shalema's perspective on us being doing this as an all-white group, because I've struggled with it, although I haven't named it much.
Thank you, Meg. I'm not sure if Richard or Shalema wants to respond to that. I'm aware of time, and so maybe have a space for one more sharing before we end for the evening.
Richard's hand's still up.
Oh, I guess I'll give 2 cents. Yeah, you know, that's Meg. I feel like that might be an ongoing argument in both communities or both sides. You know, I feel like, you know, that's a very complicated thing, because I was listening to a podcast, I think, with Dan Harrison, and he was talking with Lama Rod. I forgot what group Lama Rod is a part of, but they were talking about talks about racism and should there be separate groups, like should there be a safe space for white people to come together and feel comfortable to talk. And I believe at one point he said, there's two things. Like he said, yes, you know, there should be discussions among the white community that provides a space for openness, security, a safe place, and then also coming together, you know, or discussing it with their friends of color. Because he did say that in some communities, and it depends on the time, some people of color might feel triggered sometimes, and that might not allow a place of safety and healing for, I guess, a white person to sit with the issue without triggering a person of color. But I believe it's still up in the air, and I think it depends on groups. But I don't know. I think I like the discussing separately and maybe coming together, or finding a person of color that you feel comfortable with and who knows that you're grappling with these issues, because I would say not everyone would feel welcoming for various reasons of being triggered, their own place and time, where they're at. So I say it's not an easy answer, and it's, you know, it's like most issues in the world, is complicated, you know. So
I didn't suspect it was an easy answer.
Yeah. Thank you for responding. And, you know, it's in our Sangha life to be raising this question. And I thank everybody for being here tonight, for participating and sharing and, you know, sitting with all of this. And I think I just want to end by saying, America is a product of racism, and we are all dehumanized. We are all harmed by racism. And I think of something that Joanna Macy says, which is that we're all made of the same stuff: earth, air, fire, and water. And so somehow, even on a physical level, somewhere in us, we know we're all connected. And it's from this deep knowing in us that sustains our practice and allows the wisdom to open up, to reveal to us, you know, the ways that we are interconnected and how we need to work together for the liberation of all beings. So thank you, everyone.